Hello and welcome to Martian Driving Podcast 143. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm looking at three franchise films that have come out in the last bit, kind of comparing and contrasting, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't, and just waffling endlessly about them. The first one, of course, they're all from 2018. The first one is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. The second one is The Predator. And the third one is Venom. All of them recent, all of them quite tentpole kind of movies, though Venom is a $100 million budget one rather than a really big film. But they're all in a franchise, and they're all kind of interesting failures in a way. So it's always interesting to talk about failures rather than successes. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and I'll start talking about franchise movies that don't quite work. Martian Drive-In Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Okay, so how the fuck is everybody? The weather here is no longer frightful. Spring has arrived. The days are sunny. The sky is blue with little bits of white in it. And the weather is warming up, which is always a lovely thing. And I've got some stuff I've got to do this month, which is kind of interesting. And a little bit unexpected, but I'm going to do it anyway. And challenging, too. I've got some challenging things to do before the 2nd of November. Now, my life being what it is, all of the challenges are self-imposed, so I'm not, like, complaining to anybody. I can drop them if I need to, but I'm not going to. First thing is, Sal and I are going up to Echuca overnight, which is on the border with New South Wales. It's on the Murray River, which is the biggest river in Australia, which is not very impressive with if you compare it to any other comparable continent. You can jump a motorcycle across the Murray River with not too much effort, even when it's in flood. But, yeah, we're going up there for a night, so that's going to be next week. It's going to be a bit of fun, taking it nice and easy. The other thing is, I'm going up by myself to Sydney for 9 days, and I'm flying up there, and I'm going to fly back, and I'm house-sitting for the sister and brother-in-law while they're away because they have a new cat. And so I took up that offer. Sal's staying here because she's got some stuff to do and some appointments and all that kind of thing, but I'm going to have 9 days in Sydney in the flat by myself with a cat. And I thought, what can I do for 9 days in Sydney by myself with a cat in a flat in Maroubra? And then I thought, and this is the bit where the drum roll comes in. I can try to do 9 YouTube videos in 9 days. It's a challenge. It's doable. It's very much achievable. But it means I have to be organized at a level I haven't been organized in a very long time. And that's not in itself a bad thing. There are a couple of reasons why I'm doing this. First is, of course, to fill the time. And I have all the technology I need. I've got all the equipment. I've got tripods, microphones, cameras. I've got 4 different cameras I can use. A phone camera, an action camera, a little handheld one that does quite a nice zoom, and a DSLR. I've got a tripod, and I've got a couple of different mics I can use. So it's all good. I've got that part nailed down, and I'm learning about focus and all that kind of stuff. But the big reason I want to do this, and I've been wanting to do this for a few years, in fact, I started to think about doing it as a part of the podcast, and that is I'm going to visit some of the places I was around when I was a child, where some pretty nasty things happened to me. Not kind of sexual abuse, so please don't think that. It's been more psychological and physical violence. I'm going to do a video on Monday. I'm going to make it the first day that I've got free when I get to Sydney, around Liverpool, New South Wales, where I grew up, and I'm going to talk to the camera about my experience living there. It's not going to be all down. I've got to actually end it on a couple of upbeat things that are really important to me and are really kind of nice. But I want to kind of exercise that part of my life on camera and put it down there and explain and be at the places where it actually happened and kind of put that together into a video. Hopefully it'll work. Hopefully I won't bawl on camera. And by bawl, I do mean cry and not waka chicka waka chicka. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do it partly to give my family something for the family history. I'm going to do it because it's probably the last time I'm going to be there. I really don't want to go back to Liverpool particularly, and I don't want to go back to those places particularly after this. I really want to kind of draw a line under that part of things and deal with it in a very, very 21st century way. And that's what I'm going to do. So that's going to be the first day I do. I've got some other ideas for some videos. I'm going to walk across the Harbour Bridge in Sydney and take some video walking across the Harbour Bridge. I'm going to, I'm not going to spoil it all, but I've got about four of the ideas I need so far, and the rest I can kind of make up between now and then. So that's what I'm going to be doing, and it's going to be challenging and probably, to be really honest, exhausting. But I like the idea of doing it. I need something that's really going to push me a bit. I've talked this over with good friend of the podcast, Morris, who immediately said, "You're not going to not podcast, are you?" "No, Morris, I'm still podcast. Please relax, my dear friend." But I've talked to him about it, and he seems to be a bit wow about the challenge I'm setting myself. And I talked to my friend Michaela, with whom I do the ABC radio, and she's got great faith in my ability to do it, based on not much else beside our conversations about movies. Nonetheless, I'm going to try it. I'm going to get out there. I'm going to give it a good go. I'm going to learn on the job. One of the interesting things here, and I hope this isn't boring the fuck out of you guys, because I really don't want that. Tell me if it is, and I'll stop doing it. But I pinched an idea from Kurosawa. Akira Kurosawa. I was looking at a YouTube video talking about how he directs motion and how motion and the environment around him is really important to the way he made movies and how his scenes are framed in such a way that motion and the elements and other things kind of push the narrative and intensify the narrative. And I had an idea based on that for a scene in that first video I'm going to do in Liverpool. Who the fuck knows whether it's going to be successful? It's going to require some timing. But I think learning this stuff is fucking fascinating to me, and I really want to go with it. I really kind of want to run with it, take the YouTube channel to a new level every fucking time I do a video. And I'm already learning about the editing process and doing some interesting things with that. But I really am fascinated with the idea of putting light on the screen and kind of seeing where it goes. So that's what I'm going to be doing. Until November, so I've got to take some cameras with me and get some stuff organized and stick things in bags. I haven't flown for a few years either. It's been about 3 years since Sal and I got on a plane, maybe a bit more than 3 years. So I'm going to be flying up on a budget airline from the local airport rather than the big one in Melbourne. I'm doing Avalon rather than Tullamarine, which is a lot easier for us. And I've got a seat with extra legroom. Yes, me. I paid a little bit extra for that. And I'm flying in the evening, so I'm not going to be with the tons and tons of people that fly between Sydney and Melbourne daily for business reasons, because we don't have a fast train. If we had a fast train, it'd be a 3-hour trip, but we don't have a fast train. So I'm going to do that. And hopefully I'll meet up with some friends while I'm in Sydney, which I intend to organise. It's going to be a weird time in Sydney right when I'm there too, because the Invictus Games are on, which are the games for injured military soldiers. It's kind of like an Olympic Games for injured soldiers. And so that's on while I'm in Sydney as well. So place is going to be full of ex-military people with injuries for part of the time I'm there. But I've got ways to work around that, hopefully, because it's going to be a very, very busy time in the city. But crowds are good. And that's one thing Kurosawa taught me. Crowds are good. If I can have a whole bunch of people in the background while I'm doing something or talking to a camera, it's going to make it a lot more cinematic in some way. So I'll kind of make that work for me. So that's pretty much what I've been planning, the tickets booked, the family's happily. I'm going to be visiting mum a few times as well. She's still in her nursing home with the dementia, so I'm going to catch up with her a few times in between making video. I'll probably go and visit her and then run off with a camera and a tripod and do something with the camera and tripod after a visitor. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying this stuff. We actually bought some camera gear as well. We've got a green screen now, which is kind of interesting. I also got a couple of camera lights. All of this shit's really cheap if you search around on eBay and stuff like that. I got a 2x3 meter green screen with a stand for like $35. And I got the two lights, which are big intensity lights, with the kind of cones around them and on the stands. I got those for about $40 as well. So doing this stuff isn't that expensive. I mean, the cameras are the most expensive part, but once you've got those, you're right. And you can even do it if you've got a decent phone with a decent camera on it. After that, it comes down to imagination and dedication. So all of that kind of stuff is happening. I'll put a link to the YouTube channel down the bottom. I just finished, and this was a hard one, the top 10 movie villains of the 1940s. I'll put that into a YouTube video. And the reason I say it's a hard one is, unlike doing a narrative video where you just let the camera roll once you've got what you like and you talk to the camera if you're going to be doing that kind of thing, when I'm doing a narrated one where I write a script and narrate something about something and then throw a whole bunch of pictures I find of the actors and of the movies I'm talking about, there are about 250 clips and transitions that I put into a 15-minute video. And that takes a lot of work. It's kind of also brain-burning work to do that. Whereas with something like I'm going to be doing in Sydney, it's going to be a process of cutting things down rather than expanding things out. But with the kind of narrative thing, when I do a best of or a top 10 or something like that, that I've got to go out and search for things and put them in there. But with the vlog type ones, it's more a thing of cutting out things rather than going out and hunting and gathering them. So what have I been watching in between all of this other shit? Smokey and the Bandit. That turned up on Netflix, so I haven't seen Smokey and the Bandit since Jesus was playing Cowboys. So I rewatched it with Burt Reynolds and Sally Field and Jackie Gleason, all of that kind of thing. Lots of car chases, directed by Hal Needham, who was a big stuntman. It kind of holds up well. It's a lot of fun. It's very much tongue-in-cheek. It works. It still works. Lots of police cars trashed, which is always something that people find anarchically pleasing. It kind of works. Burt Reynolds, charismatic as always. Sally Field's kind of good in it. Jackie Gleason I've got less time for because his character's more of a very, very broad caricature. Jerry Reed's in there playing his friend. And, it does hold up well. The second and third one, I'm going to check them out a little bit later, but I'm not looking forward to that because there are the laws of diminishing returns in any 1970s movie that has sequels. And this one definitely had that problem of diminishing returns. I watched Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster, which is a late 60s Godzilla movie with Hedorah, the big smog monster, which looks like a giant piece of snot with two vaginas for eyes, deliberately because the guy who designed them said he found vaginas scary. One of the things I noticed more and more, the more I watch kaiju movies of a certain age, is the beautiful detail on the model work. It's awesomely good. It's fantastic stuff. Japan's been making models and miniatures of things for hundreds and hundreds of years, so it's definitely a part of their culture and a part of the craft of their culture. And that really does work well when they're making models for Monster to Destroy. Little streetscapes, cars, the detail work on them is fantastic. And it'll almost make you cry to see them destroyed because of that wonderful level of detail that they put into them. And it's nowhere more evident than in Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster. There are some really fantastic bits of model work in there, as well as your usual Godzilla stuff and the human beings trying to help with things. It's a good, honest kaiju movie. Directed, like all the good ones, by Ishiro Honda, Isuru Honda, sorry. And, yeah, it was nice revisiting that. I did see a kind of vulgar pleasure movie as well. Super Troopers 2, which has got Brian Cox, Rob Lowe's in it, and all the usual Broken Lizard guys. A lot of dick jokes, a lot of silliness in there, a lot of making fun of Canadians and Americans. Gross out humor to the max. It's not any better than it has to be. It was kind of entertaining in its own fucked up way. Apparently it was crowdfunded for the initial seed money. They need to raise $2 million and raised it quite quickly for the sequel to Super Troopers. And then the studios came on and gave them the other $10 million they needed to make the film. Suppose it might make a decent double feature with Smokey and the Bandit, come to think of it. But if you're into that kind of film, check it out. I did see a Burt I. Gordon movie from 1960 starring Richard Carlson called Tormented, which is a kind of a ghost story and pretty fucked up. A guy accidentally doesn't help his girlfriend when she falls off the top of a lighthouse, and he's haunted by her when his fiance is on board. Richard Carlson's about 20 years too old for the role, and the special effects are no better than a Burt I. Gordon movie from 1960 would suggest. There's a disembodied head of his girlfriend wandering around and all of that kind of stuff. Interesting thing about it is there's an early role in it by Joe Turkel, who was in Blade Runner playing Terrell. So, yeah, it's interesting to go back and watch some of these drive-in flicks, but there's not a hell of a lot you can say about them, apart from the fact that bikinis were an interesting phenomenon of the 1960s, and we don't really see enough of them in modern cinema. Two other things I watched. First one is Kiss of Death, the 1947 Kiss of Death, not the more recent abortion of a film with Nicolas Cage, with Victor Mature, Brian Donlevy, Colleen Gray, and Richard Widmark in his first movie playing Tommy Udo. I did that actually so I could talk about it when I did the YouTube video of best villains of the 1940s. And spoiler, Tommy Udo is definitely on that list. Yeah, it's a good, honest little noir. A lot of fun. Victor Mature's lead character is pretty fucking boring, mostly because Victor Mature doesn't give us too much variation in the character he plays, which is a bit of a shame. Brian Donlevy's there with his rug on. We also get to see Carl Malden in a very early role as one of the assistants to the DA, played by Brian Donlevy. And yeah, but Richard Widmark is Tommy Udo. Fantastic. Throwing a lady in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs, being totally crazy. He's a joke. He's a character with a very much the feeling of the Joker from Batman in it, even though it was made 7 years after the Joker was developed for the cartoon series. Tommy Udo has a very Joker vibe, a very kind of Heath Ledger Joker vibe about him, which made it quite interesting. I revisited a fun film from 20 years ago as well, which I reviewed 20 years ago for Festival website, and that is The Relic with Tom Sizemore and Penelope Ann Miller. Really nice Stan Winston effects on the monster, the Cthulhu. It's got Linda Hunt in it as well. It's a nice late 1990s monster movie. James Whitmore's in there as well, a kind of callback to James Whitmore in Them. And he gets some good lines in there. You've got Audra Lindley playing an older coroner who does an autopsy and gets some really nice lines in, which is kind of great. There's the kind of role that would normally be played by a male actor, but Audra Lindley as a female coroner with a kind of sick graveyard sense of humour has a couple of nice moments in this film. And if you haven't seen The Relic for a while, I know here in Australia you can pick up a Blu-ray of it for pocket change, and it's worth having in your collection. And it's a nice, honest, late 1990s monster flick. You've got to love that. I also saw Venom, but I'll talk about that later. One of the problems we had when we saw Venom is the fact that we got 23 minutes of fucking commercials before the movie started, which pisses me off because I've never seen an ad in a movie, like this before the start of a movie, for any product I wanted to buy, really. Unless I wanted to buy a 10-year-old a private school education, or I wanted to support a local AFL team. Those ads are just basically wasted time for me. So what I usually do is play Pokemon Go on my phone until the movie starts, but it still pisses me off that I'm sitting in there almost as a captive audience, living through these fucking commercials. But anyway, I'll talk about Venom in a little bit. So time to take a break. When I get back, I'll talk about the first of these three movies, and it'll be Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
She's tracked. Okay, come on.
Okay. Are you okay?
I'm okay.
How many can you save?
11 species. Blue is the last of her kind.
You'll never capture her.
We thought you might know someone who could help.
A rescue op? What could go wrong?
Hey, Blue. You know me.
Come with me. You know you can't stay here.
Pack your men up right now.
It was all a lie!
The man who proved raptors can follow orders.
You never thought how many millions a trained predator might be worth?
They're gonna sell them.
Not Blue. They need it for something else.
What is that thing?
They made it.
This is the most dangerous creature that ever walked the earth.
I say we shut this whole thing down.
Hey, girl. You think what I'm thinking?
Genetic power has now been unleashed.
You can't put it back in the box.
Blue!
If I don't make it back, remember you're the one who made me come here.
I'll be all right.
These creatures were here before us. And if we're not careful, they're gonna be here after. Welcome to Jurassic World.
Dinosaur movies are of their nature cool. We were all kind of wired into them because we saw so many of them as children. For me, it was Ray Harryhausen stop motion monsters in things like Valley of Guanji, which I loved. Cowboys and Dinosaurs was a natural match for me. And Cowboys versus Aliens less so, of course, as Daniel Craig showed. But there's a kind of welded on audience for any kind of dinosaur movie that does things quite well. We can put aside things like the movies made by The Asylum, amongst other things. They're willfully bad, but a good, honest dinosaur movie using the best technology available at the time is always going to get an audience. Whether it was Willis O'Brien back in the silent movie days doing The Lost World, or whether it's right up at the moment a movie like Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. You only get a certain amount of the people who really just go for that instinctively. Since 1993, when Jurassic Park first came out, dinosaurs have looked realistic. Even the ones in the original Jurassic Park hold up well to our eyes, with a couple of exceptions. They weren't all done with computers. There were some physical effects with those dinosaurs as well. But it worked really well and continues to do so in the franchise. So now we're up to the fifth one, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which I'm kind of ambivalent about. I can see where all of the joins are, which kind of makes it problematic for me. But on the other hand, it's a dinosaur movie. Of course, it stars some of the same people who are in the first Jurassic World movie. We have Chris Pratt playing Owen Grady, who's a Navy veteran, an ethnologist, and Velociraptor handler. I've got to stop trying to speak so fast. And his one-time love interest, Claire Deering, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, who used to run operations in Jurassic World and now fights for dinosaur rights with a not-for-profit organization she put together called the Dinosaur Protection Group. We have also a callback to the first Jurassic Park with Jeff Goldblum's Ian Malcolm, who does a couple of speeches in front of a Senate committee. Now, it's interesting that they do the Senate committee bit with Goldblum, because it's pretty clear that the senators are US senators in the age of Trump. They don't know much about science and they don't like what they know. You very much get that impression in the small space of time that we're with those characters, where the Senate committee decides to let the dinosaurs die because the island on which they are living, Isla Nublar, is getting volcanic as fuck and is going to destroy itself very, very soon. So the government decided we're going to let nature take its course and get rid of the dinosaurs. Of course, that doesn't happen because that way the franchise would die if it did. So we've got a few other people involved in this. I'll go through the villains first and then we'll go into some of the good guys. We've got B.D. Wong coming back as Henry Wu, who used to be the head geneticist at Jurassic World in the original Jurassic Park. He doesn't get a lot of stuff there. He's motivated basically by science. He just wants the science to go ahead, and whatever will fund the science that he wants to do, he's on board with. We then have Rafe Spall playing Eli Mills, who is the assistant of a very wealthy man who was a business partner to John Hammond, the guy who created Jurassic Park. His name is Sir Benjamin Lockwood, played with a slightly ropey English accent by James Cromwell. Lockwood's decided to save the dinosaurs and he's found another island where he wants to put them and he wants to preserve them for further study, which is understandable. But his assistant, Rafe Spall's Eli Mills, has got a secret plan where he's going to basically sell off all of the dinosaurs they rescue from Isla Nublar and flog them off to billionaires, because what could possibly go wrong? But to get the dinosaurs sold to billionaires, you've got to rescue them first. And that's where Ted Levine's character, Ken Wheatley, comes along. He's a mercenary and he has this penchant for collecting dinosaur teeth out of the mouths of live dinosaurs so he can make himself a necklace. Along with Owen and Claire, we have a couple of new characters. Franklin Webb, played by a guy called Justin Smith, who used to be an IT tech at Jurassic World and is the systems analyst they need to go in and get the dinosaurs. And Daniela Pineda playing Zia Rodriguez, a former Marine who's now part of the Dinosaur Protection Group's paleo veterinarian. She's their paleo veterinarian because that's a thing in the Jurassic World universe. So they all go to Isla Nublar just as it's about to go ballistic, literally ballistic, and they've got to track down and find the dinosaurs. They need Claire because she's the only person with a handprint who can unlock the security systems in Jurassic World, and they need Owen because the whole point of the deal is to get his old Velociraptor friend Blue. So that's all you basically need to know at the start of the film. The gang's getting back together. They're going to a dangerous place, an island full of dinosaurs, which is about to go turn into a mound of lava, basically. It's a really old school thing. Islands full of dinosaurs that end up blowing up in a volcano to neatly tie off the loose end at the end of a movie. That shit's been going on since at least the 1930s. But they do it very well in this. The effects are fantastic. The dinosaurs are terrific. And there are lots of action set pieces which kind of work in some cases and kind of don't work in others. They don't really bend in the direction of science as much as I'd like them to. There are things like people don't realize that the radiant heat you get from lava can burn you from a long distance. That's kind of ignored in the movie for visually striking purposes. You can't run out of a pyroclastic flow and not be burnt, because pyroclastic flows, which is that great flow of rock and dust and clouds of lava dust that come down the side of mountains like Mount Pinatubo in Indonesia, those things are 900 degrees centigrade. If you're inside one of those, basically what you're going to be is like a chicken cooked in clay. That's basically how you're going to end up. Doesn't happen in this movie because they think it looks good. Now, I was kind of thinking it through on this reviewing of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And if you obey the science, if you say, right, science is the strict rules of our action sequences, we're not going to drift to one side of it, we're going to obey the rules of science and do things as realistic as possible. in some of these action sequences, there are possibilities that would have been really cool, at least as cool as the shit they actually did on screen, visually and also from a point of tension. It would have been scarier if you had... Now, I'm going to do the spoilers here. Of course, I always do spoilers on these things. If you demonstrate what a pyroclastic cloud does and then have Owen trying to keep ahead of it, you would have got much, much more tension in the particular action sequence, which is in the trailer a bit, than you did by basically fudging the science, because the amount of menace and the amount of tension would have been ramped up, because if that shit touches him, he's instantly going to be a chicken cooked in clay. The fact that they didn't choose to do that shows that they're limited in the way they're thinking. So have a look at that next time you see a movie where they get the science wrong, and just think about what would have happened had they got the science right and what opportunities they missed because they fucked it up. And it's not like a movie with this kind of a budget isn't going to have a shit ton of scientific advisors available. There are whole companies that offer science advisors to Hollywood. And this one had a $187 million budget. It ended up making $1.3 billion. So nobody's going to make a loss on it. But I kind of wish that movies like this kind of lent towards the science a little more and made themselves much better because of the opportunities that kind of gave them. But they didn't. Now, there's a second act in this movie, which is the problematic part, where the dinosaurs get to Lockwood's estate and they start auctioning them off. The auctioneer in this case is played by one of my favourite movie villains, Toby Jones, playing a guy called Gunnar Eversole, which is another dig. There are a couple of digs to Trumpism in this movie. And his hair is very Trumpian, particularly when it gets blown around. And that's a deliberate choice by the movie makers. The fact that Toby Jones' character Gunnar only cares about money is one thing, and we all know somebody famous with bad hair who only cares about money and doesn't listen to any contrary opinion makes this great. And the fact that Toby Jones is such a short actor was another problem, deliberate choice there. There are going to be some interesting studies done in the future of the ways in which Trump's America is reflected in cinema. I think this is definitely going to be one of the movies that will get, in the very least, name-checked in that kind of a study. The second part of this movie is kind of weird, where it turns into almost a haunted house thing with the auction going on in the basement. The good guys are trapped. The good guys escape. They're chased by dinosaurs through a very large house, which has kind of an enormous museum area as a part of it. And that kind of plays back to the director's strong points as a director and the things that he liked. J.A. Bayona, the director, had made The Orphanage and A Monster Calls, and he was kind of comfortable in that almost early Guillermo del Toro kind of setting. And so the movie twisted in that direction, and it's filmed very much in that way. It's raining, there's thunder around. It's supposed to be in the Pacific Northwest, but it's kind of in a timeless part of America where you don't quite know where it is, even though it's name-checked. It's a place that kind of looks and feels, because of all the English actors in it, like Ralph Spall and Toby Jones, like a part of England, though it really isn't. They go through the beats of the action things where people barely escape enormous dinosaurs, more out of luck, or Deus Ex Velociraptor. And that part kind of doesn't work because it seems like it's a different movie than the first part. But then they come to some moral questions which make it very interesting. Where are the limits in these kind of genetic technologies? The problems of weaponizing dinosaurs is brought up and give a good leadway into the next movie, which I think is coming out in 2021. It's going to be directed by Colin Trevorrow, who directed the first Jurassic World movie. So there are a lot of... This second movie in a proposed trilogy is basically the setup for some very interesting possibilities, if they don't fuck it up, in the third one. So in a sense, it's a launching ramp for the third movie as much as it is anything else, moving from the failed amusement park in the first one to a world where dinosaurs are on the loose in the wild. This movie is kind of a ramp towards that. And I can kind of accept it as that, though that second act with the dinosaurs in the house and all of the auctions and things like that kind of doesn't work for me. Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard are fine in this. Ted Levine is always a lot of fun in whichever movie he appears in. Rafe Spall's kind of okay. Toby Jones definitely is having some fun. Geraldine Chaplin's in there as well, which is kind of cool because I liked her in a movie I talked about on Paleo Cinema Podcast a long time ago, a spy movie called Innocent Bystanders. So it's good to see her in there, and she's a very important plot point, even though she doesn't get much oxygen in this kind of a movie because a lady in her 70s isn't going to be running away from dinosaurs. She's 74 at the moment. Isn't going to be running away with dinosaurs alongside Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt. But the movie kind of works in parts and kind of doesn't work in parts, but it does lead to some interesting possibilities for the next one. And there are some sequences right at the end of the film that lead into that. So this movie, in a sense, is a prequel to a much more interesting movie, I think, which is going to be the third one, if they don't fuck it up and if they don't let the suits and the spreadsheet readers have their way and they don't get too careful and precious with it. I think that what this franchise needs is a movie that goes balls to the wall with the concept. Now, I don't necessarily mean it's got to be gory to hell, but they've really got to use their imagination a lot more and kind of show us something we haven't seen before with dinosaurs on the loose. And if they do that, I think it's going to be a very long franchise. But the way things are going with franchises in Hollywood particularly, they do tend to play careful and tend to second guess themselves into diluting the property. And that's a big issue with a lot of these kind of films, as I'll speak about when I talk about the other two films. But anyway, I'll take another break now, and when we get back, I will talk about The Predator.
May we have a word?
Let me guess. He's done something crazy.
Shove me again, I want to break your neck.
Welcome to the Looney Bus.
McKenna.
Nebraska Williams.
That's Coyle.
That's Lynch.
With Merks.
Why are you here?
I don't think you believe me. Come on, man. I had a run-in with a space alien.
Light him up!
This fucking guy is crazier than the rest of us.
What the fuck was that?
That's the thing that killed my man.
Alien.
Guess who's back? It ain't a fucking question. Ain't no one think about when the presence of a living legend.
Predators. It exploits weakness. Tracks its prey. Like a game. Seems to enjoy it.
That's not a predator. That's a sports hunter.
Well, we took a vote. Predator's cooler, right? Fuck yeah.
Do you have a plan? Ex-sniper with PTSD and a team that's mental? You're insane, right?
Yeah! Gentlemen, they're large, they're fast, and fucking you up's their idea of tourism.
Figured something out. I think we're gonna die.
Just pointing it out.
My big boy's a hunter. He brought his dogs with him.
Come on!
You are now not in the presence of nice guys.
The Predator.
Let's just face it, The Predator is a fucked up movie. There are a number of reasons why. The script was messed around with, the third act was rewritten extensively. There were characters and situations cut from it at the last minute to make it fit a certain runtime. Characters like a general played by Edward James Olmos were cut out of it. There were some scenes filmed with good predators working alongside soldiers, which didn't happen in the movie. And because it was a script by Shane Black and Fred Decker, who had worked together on the Monster Squad way back in 1987, and one of whom was Shane Black, there were big expectations on this movie that just weren't fulfilled, which is a great shame because I had some pretty good expectations for it, being that it was going to be based on a Shane Black script and directed by Shane Black. But something went wrong in the mix, and that's unfortunate. The trailer pretty much tells the story. A bunch of loony army guys meet up with an army ranger sniper who's had a previous encounter with the Predator and for some reason has mailed parts of its equipment, its technical equipment, not like it's junk, but it's equipment, back home for his further study, and his autistic son gets hold of it and learns how to use the equipment. A super predator comes to Earth and decides that he's going to incorporate the best of our DNA into their own genome, and another predator's involved, which has escaped the other predator, and shit gets really crazy there. Now, I'm not too sure what the predator was thinking, but I'm pretty sure that it may not have wanted any DNA from Republican Americans to improve any species, or for that matter, any DNA from Australian One Nation voters. By the way, I did a YouTube video on what I think the next 5 Predator movies should be. I'll put a link on that in the show notes so you can check that one out. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek and a bit silly, and I changed my mind on a couple of them after it was uploaded because I am that way inclined, you know, mercuric and crazy. And so you can check that out as well. But the Predator I like. I like the franchise. I love the iconic Stan Winston monster. It's just one of those designs that works really well. And Shane Black and Fred Decker's script is right. It is an ambush predator. It's not really an ambush predator, sorry. It's more of a sports hunter. And I think that a franchise called Sports Hunter may not have had the same cachet as calling it Predator. But nonetheless, there are some moments in there that are pretty cool, some of which are in the trailer, some of which are not. One of the things, and again, spoilers, because I'm doing spoilers in this one, those great kind of toothy claws on the mandibles on the face of the Predator have never been used to full effect in a movie up to this point. And in this one, they are. We see what they do and we see what they're for. And that part is pretty fucking cool. From a geeky fanboy point of view, I was like, yeah, on that one. Now, one of the things that I think is a weakness in this one, there are some good actors in it and they're given some good lines, but for the most part, Boyd Holbrook as the protagonist, Quinn McKenna, kind of leaves me a bit cold. He's a kind of generic working class American guy kind of character. And even though he gets some kind of working class cred being a part-time carpenter in Kentucky, he in an earlier stage of his life, I'm not sure that he's really skilled and charismatic enough to carry a movie like this, which is a bit unfortunate. I know, well, they only had the $88 million budget, and one of the problems with that is you can't necessarily get an actor of high skill and high name recognition for your main protagonist. Now, they do have a good supporting cast in this one. Olivia Munn playing Casey Brackett is very good, even though her character's underwritten. And there's a scene at the start of the movie where she's hassled by a guy, which gives us a little more of her character, which they had to cut from the film because the actor in question was a real-life sex predator. And Olivia Munn insisted that it be removed, rightly so. But, yeah, she's good in that. Sterling K. Brown, again, the role's a bit shit, but he plays Will Traeger, a government agent who's in charge of the project to study and learn about the Predators. Keegan-Michael Key, a fine actor and a fine comedian as well, plays Coyle, a guy who's basically a nutcase. We get Thomas Jane, who, of course, was in The Expanse, amongst other things, and in The Mist, plays Baxley. One of the interesting things about Baxley that people don't hear, unless I'm mistaken, and I hope I'm not, there's a moment where Baxley tells Coyle that he's faked having Tourette syndrome so that they could stick together in the nut house. I may have misheard that, but that's what I think. So he's a character who's faking Tourette syndrome, as far as I could hear, on the one time I did watch the movie, because he and Keegan-Michael Key's character Coyle have either a bromance or a full-on relationship. It's not really clear from this movie which one it is. We've got Alfie Allen playing Lynch, another former Marine. We have Australian actor Yvonne Strahovski playing Quinn's wife and the mother of his autistic son, Rory, played by Jacob Tremblay. We get a little bit of Jake Busey playing the son of the character his father played in Predator 2. And a few other bits and pieces of people around who didn't really make any impact. Now, this movie was pretty much doomed from the start. The chief executive officer of 20th Century Fox, Stacey Snyder, said this about Shane Black and Fred Dekker's script. And again, this is kind of undercutting it and damning with faint praise. We've got a Predator film coming out that's unexpected and utterly fresh. I just imagine that it will be 500 hours. It will take 500 hours to read the script, that it will be interior jungle, exterior more jungle, and then fighting happening. But Emma Watts went out to recruit Shane Black. From the first page, it didn't read like a Predator film. It's set in suburbia. There's a little boy and his dad at the center of the action. And I think that's one of the problems. They were expecting a Predator movie, and what they got was some of the beats of the film rejigged from Iron Man 3. The older guy and the kid who's very, very smart, and the kind of cute dialogue there. Shane Black really needs to kind of lean off of his tropes, the smart kid and the older guy teaming up with them. He did it in The Nice Guys. He's done it in The Last Boy Scout. He did it in The Last Action Hero. He really needs to find a new shtick. Fine writer. I like him a lot. I really liked him in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, what he did with that. And I think that that's the kind of direction he should go in. He should get away from just kind of doing variations on what he's done before, because I think he's got a unique voice. I think he's very funny. I think he's very stylish. I think he does action films unlike any action films other people do. But he needs to get away from these tropes. Whether it was something that was imposed upon him by the studio, whether it's something he and Fred Dekker came up with on their own, it really doesn't play well. There's also a tacked-on bit at the end of the film, which is a rewritten ending, which I don't know is going to play very well, and I don't think it's the sort of thing you could hang a sequel from, because it's a little too Marvel in some ways, without giving away exactly what it is, for it to really have legs. I do like the Predator dogs, though. The Predator dogs worked for me, even though one of them was lobotomized by a bullet and then turned into a puppy. I like the idea. I liked it when it was in Predators back in 2010. That was kind of good. If you're going to have somebody who's a sports hunter, they are definitely going to have hunting dogs with them. It makes sense to do that. And the movies present that in an interesting way. But then I was a person who liked the Hulk dogs in the Ang Lee Hulk. I thought that was one of the moments of wonder in that movie, which I've got a soft spot for. It's very much a vulgar pleasure for me to rewatch that one, even though the CG on the Hulk is a little bit ropey and the transfer to Blu-ray hasn't done it any favours either. But, yeah, big monstrous dogs I'm there for. They may be the new dinosaurs for me. But to kind of wrap it up a little bit on the Predator, I think it's a missed opportunity. I don't know that they're going to push it further with the franchise anytime in the next 5 to 8 years, because money's too tight to mention. And in the manner that Venom used one third of its funds from a Chinese production company, I think if the Predator franchise has got legs, it's going to be with these international co-productions, and that in itself gives certain limitations on the way and to what extent certain stories can be told. But anyway, I'm going to take it a break. I'll play you the trailer from Venom, and then I'll talk about why I think that one's a bit of a missed opportunity too. We are Venom.
I'm Eddie Brock. I'm a reporter.
I always seem to find myself
questioning
something the government may not be looking at. I found something really bad. And I have been...
Who said that?
Taken. Look around at the world. What do you see? A planet on the brink of collapse. Human beings are disposable. But man and symbiote combined. This is a new race, a new species. A higher life form.
What do you want from me?
You'll find out.
I'm so sorry.
We cannot just hurt people.
Look into my eyes, Eddie. The way I see it, we can do whatever we want. Do we have a deal? Eyes, lungs, pancreas, so many snacks, so little time.
That power, it's not completely awful.
You have no idea how much you're scaring me right now.
Eddie, cooperate. And you just might survive.
Guys, you do not want to do this, trust me. Giant leaps will always come at a cost.
I have a parasite. Yeah. Name is Chen.
Right off the bat, I've got to say, I'm not a fan of Tom Hardy. I've never seen him in anything I liked him in. I think that he's just not my kind of guy in a lot of ways. There's something about him that rubs me the wrong way. But having said that, there are things that are fun in Venom, the 2018 movie, in which he stars, directed by Ruben Fleischer, who directed Zombieland, which ain't no bad credit to have in your life. It also stars Michelle Williams, who plays Anne Weying, his ex-fiance. Riz Ahmed playing a guy called Carlton Drake, who is kind of like Elon Musk as a James Bond villain. I did actually have a chat on the radio about this one. And one of the things Michaela and I talked about is the fact that there are a group of very, very wealthy billionaires, which is a bit of an oxymoron, really, who think the world's going to shit whatever they do. And they're looking for ways out. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. Richard Branson wants a human presence in space. And a whole bunch of other ones are building enormous bunkers, which they're going to populate with who the fuck knows what for the coming apocalypse. And Riz Ahmed, as Carlton Drake, gives us a really kind of interesting character there who believes that in order for us to go to space, we need to accept these weird symbiotes he found in outer space, integrate them into our own DNA, and use them, in a sense, as spacesuits to go out into space and to spread human life and capitalism throughout the universe. It doesn't quite work out that way for him. I'll just give you a spoiler on that particular one. It's really funny, too, in some ways, because you've got Tom Hardy and you've got Riz Ahmed, which is basically two English guys talking at each other antagonistically with American accents, which always strikes me as a bit funny when I hear it, because neither Tom Hardy nor Riz Ahmed's accents are on point from my ear. I mean, if you're in the US and you think I'm wrong, please tell me. But that didn't quite ring true to me. They didn't have that slight regionality you get in real people's voices. Didn't really kind of work for me in that way. Now, there are a couple of other actors who get really, really underfed as far as the writing's concerned. We've got Jenny Slate as Dora Skirth, who's one of the scientists at Carlton Drake's Life Foundation. I always liked Jenny Slate. I've seen her do comedy as well, and she's very good at that too. Melora Walters is in there playing a homeless woman called Maria, who's a friend of Eddie Brock's. Melora Walters I like a lot as well. Oddly enough, for somebody with that name, she was born in Saudi Arabia, which is kind of weird. I remember her from Hard Eight and Boogie Nights and Magnolia, amongst other things. Fine actor. Didn't get a lot to do in this film, which is unfortunate. But as far as Venom himself is concerned, see?
Anybody can do a Venom voice.
It's dead easy. Venom itself never really clicked for me. It's just this big, ugly, aggressive blob of black space jism who wants to eat people for reasons of why the fuck not. And I was actually thinking it through, and when I was chatting with Michaela, I thought, one of the problems I got with this film is that Eddie and Venom come to the decision they're only going to eat bad people, one of whom is a guy who robs the local bodega, of course, where Eddie shops, amongst other things. And it kind of occurred to me, knowing a little bit about the universe and how it works, particularly with regarding human beings, a lot of people who are criminals for two reasons: extreme economic disadvantage and mental illness. And they're the people Venom is going to prey on. I'm not good with that. Merchant bankers and sociopathic CEOs, I'm on board with that. I can totally go and agree to that. I think blowing up a rocket may be not the best way to do that, but I'm on board with that if Venom wants to go that way. But they're also kind of going the simplistic and, dare I say, slightly American route of assuming that all criminals are bad people, whereas that's not always the case, and the universe is more complex than that. That's probably one of the things that's a real problem with this film. Eddie Brock isn't a likable character. He is dishonest. He's an investigative journalist who's too stupid to know when to be subtle and when to not piss off a big CEO. You don't confront them to their face in a place where they can chuck you out. You do your investigation and you reveal what you find. And if he had have just waited, then Doris Kearth would have given him what he wanted anyway. So him going off the rails and stealing information from his fiance and then shirt fronting the CEO of a major corporation shows that he's a stupid fuck. And I don't really get on board with protagonists that are stupid fucks. I never liked Forrest Gump. And so Eddie's not likable. Venom's not likable. The bad guy's not likable. Michelle Williams is okay, but she's an actor whose skills deserve a lot better than this film. Better than now and then everybody has to cash a check. So basically all the women in this one are underwritten. There are also bits and pieces that annoyed me because there are other symbionts, and particularly Riot, who has to travel from Malaysia to California to kind of meet up with Venom, and it has to travel in various people's bodies to get from A to B. Now, one of the problems is we see the spaceship crash in Malaysia and the search and rescue people come and try to get it. Here's what happens. The spaceship crashes in a temperate forest, which Malaysia does not have one fucking inch of. And the search and rescue people who come out to investigate are all wearing heavy jackets, which doesn't happen in Malaysia. Malaysia is near the equator. It is fucking hot, and when it's not fucking hot, it is hot and wet. You do not wear big, thick, padded jackets if you are an emergency service person in Malaysia. And the landscape and the trees are all wrong for it. That put me right off at the start. That was a cheap thing. They would have been able to cover up quite easily had they thought of it. Again, use the science. Use what's there. So anyway, Wright gets to California, ends up inside Riz Ahmed, who loves the fact that he's got a parasite of his own, and shit gets real. But that Malaysia bit pissed me off. It's a bit like people wandering through a freshwater swamp in Saudi Arabia. It's just not going to happen. That's not the landscape. That's not the people. So that kind of pissed me off. Now, one of the other things, too, is this movie had a budget. And again, it comes down to budget in a lot of cases. Roughly $100 million. If you're going to do what they were hoping to be the start of Venomverse kind of universe, because there's a really weird connection between Marvel, Columbia Pictures, and Sony. In this one, Sony's got the rights to certain Spider-Man characters. They've agreed not to touch Spider-Man for a while yet, but they've got, I think it's 204 different subsidiary characters from the Spider-Man comics that they have access to, and Venom's one of them. So they wanted to start this universe. And there's a little teaser at the end of the movie in a mid-credit sequence, which suggests the direction in which they want to take this next. But I'm not sure that Venom and the Venom sub-franchise really has the variety we need to make it kind of interesting. Here's what the other thing that a $100 million budget does. It limits your ability to use special effects. And if you have a look at any kind of mid-range special effects movie, The Predator and this one, a lot of the action stuff is filmed at night, and there's a very specific reason why that occurs. And that is you can get away with slightly lesser special effects if you film at night, and because, you know, you don't have to have quite the high definition that you would for a day shot. You don't need to worry about kind of sun shadows and all those sorts of things. There's all this stuff you can dispense with, which saves you money. And so any movie with a special effects heavy story that can't afford to do it in bright daylight, or even somewhere like the planet Titan with Thanos, they're going to film it at night because that saves them money. And now that I know that, it's becoming a kind of thing going, okay, they're filming it at night, it mustn't have had a big budget. Now, there's nothing wrong with a movie having a limited budget and trying to work within that to tell a really interesting story. Problem is, this one doesn't. And the other problem is that there's really nothing in Venom that we haven't seen better elsewhere. A lot of people have said this, and I thought it myself before I heard people say it as well. So great minds are thinking alike on this. This would have been a cool movie 10 years ago. But since Iron Man, the game's changed. It's changed enormously. So what you need to do with a $100 million movie is tell a smaller scale story. You know, peel it back. Don't try to compete with the big boys. Find a good story, character-based, interesting, sense of wonder intact. Use your special effects as a condiment and not a gravy. Don't smear it everywhere. Use it exactly where it's going to do the most good. Use it for the umami that it has in it. And you can go far. Have a look at a movie like Chronicle, which used special effects sparingly and based it on character. That's going to work. Now, the other problem with that, doing that in this case, is that you've got the studio hanging their next home, next mistress, and next Tesla on you being an enormous success. So you've got to go big or go home. And that's self-defeating. The genre that I most compare superhero movies to is Westerns. Westerns don't have to be on an enormous scale. Not everything has to be a great big How the West Was Won. You can have a Bud Bedecker movie in there. You can have a little Audie Murphy movie that kind of works. You can have Tom Grice, Will Penny. It's a broad enough genre that you can tell different kinds of stories and get interesting results and also make money from them. The problem is that studios want to make all the money right now. That might work to a certain extent with Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, because it's made over $1 billion now and it's definitely going to get a sequel. But it's still a movie that 5 years from now nobody's really going to remember much about, because it doesn't stick in the mind. It's not something that's groundbreaking in any way except box office. And then you've got The Predator, where studio interference and studio second-guessing has changed the story, and that they didn't have enough faith in it to invest more than $88 million into the production. And then you've got a movie like this where Sony is looking for a big bankroll and a big money spinner, and they've chosen the wrong property and they simply don't know it. So yeah, they're three unsuccessful movies in their own ways. One's forgettable, the other two were messed around with to such an extent. Well, actually, let me rephrase it. The first one's incredibly successful, but ultimately forgettable. The second one was interfered with by the studio and the story wasn't told anywhere near as well as it should have been. And the third one was the wrong property to try to use as a tentpole for a new franchise. So that's what I've got to say about those three films. Thank you for listening. I appreciate that. This one is a few days late because I had so much trouble getting the shit together for that YouTube video. But anyway, look after yourselves. I'll be back very soon with the Paleo Cinema podcast. I'm going to keep podcasting through the Sydney trip. And I'll be back in a fortnight with another Martian Drive-In. So I'm going to leave you with the credits, of course, to thank the wonderful Patreon supporters who donate as little as $1 US per month to keep the podcast going and to keep me off the streets. So it's just to keep the podcast going. It's a self-funding podcast. So thanks again for that. Join the Patreon mob if you want to, because they are all wonderful. They all get laid exactly as often as they want to. They always have fantastic orgasms, and they're all going to heaven. So here are the credits to honour those people. I'll play a little music afterwards as well, just as an outro. So take care, and I'll catch you guys really soon. Thank you.